Enjoy the program. Ken, are you there?
I'm here. Good evening, Dave.
I can't see you, Ken.
I'm hiding behind the various monitors. Yeah, right. Okay, maybe clear some space here. Good evening, listeners. This is In Context. We're on the first Sunday of every month at 10 p.m. in Dave's show, and we're also on the first Wednesday of every month at 6:30 p.m. before Chris Teske's show. So thank you for joining us tonight. Over the past 12 days, world attention has focused on mass protests by Egyptians against the regime of the U.S.-backed strongman Hosni Mubarak. What does this uprising mean for Egypt, the region, and the world? In today's program, we're going to discuss the developments in Egypt with Suad El-Azhar, an Egyptian-American political scientist and writer with residences in both America and Egypt, who has been closely following the uprising. And later in the program, we'll announce our call-in number so that you can join the discussion on this important subject. Dave, did you want to take a music break while we bring on Suad?
She's there.
Oh, she's on? Okay, great. Hello, Suad. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for joining us. Our guest is Suad El-Azhar, and she is a graduate of the American University in Cairo, and she studies diplomacy and conflict management at Norwich University in New Hampshire. She's also the founder of the website and blog Egypt Now, which is located at egyptnow.webs.com. Suad has residences in both Cairo and the U.S., and tonight she's speaking with us from Ohio, where she lives with her husband, my son, March. Suad, you've been following the events in Egypt, not only through the mass media, but also through your many contacts in Egypt. Do you think that the present standoff can be peacefully resolved without the resignation of Hosni Mubarak?
Well, that's an interesting question. The past 12 days have pretty much amounted to a deadlock between a very persistent dictator and lots of people. He so far has shown no signs of willingness to give up power. However, there are a number of concessions that the government is agreeing to make. Today, the vice president, or new vice president, who was the former chief of intelligence, Omar Suleiman, met with a body of political opposition members and offered three key concessions. One was to allow the freedom of the press. The second was to release detainees that have been detained in the past 12 days, and to eventually lift the emergency law. Those are really big concessions for the Egyptian opposition. But there's definitely a trust issue going on here. There's really nothing to kind of prove that they'll go follow through with these sort of promises and concessions. But the fact that talks have begun is definitely a positive sign. Even if he does stay in for the next couple of months, which unfortunately seems likely, these are definitely things to look forward to and to attempt to get underway.
I think what I'd be worried about if I was participating in the protests is that as soon as our group abandoned the square, that a Mubarak secret state police might reassert their power and try to return to the previous status quo.
That is definitely a real fear. In the past 2 weeks, thousands of Egyptians have been detained, which is why that's now a key playing chip in these concessions and in these talks. A lot of people fear for their safety, but a lot of people have endured over 30 years of tyrannical rule and kind of see the gains outweighing the costs.
Well, now this uprising in Egypt came hard on the heels of the uprising in Tunisia, which caused the American-backed dictator there to flee the country. What do you see as the principal reasons for this uprising? Is it domestic politics? Does it have to do with Egypt's policy towards Israel and Palestine? Does it have to do with the high unemployment, high food prices? What do you think is driving the mass protests?
The largest protests in recent history that are comparable to these were in the 70s, and those were over rising food prices as well. That's definitely a key factor. Economics is always a key factor. But the example in Tunis, I think, granted it broke the fear barrier, pretty much, for a lot of people. For a very long time, people had this common notion that, you know, change wasn't likely and that the costs were just too much to bear, but to see a living example of it actually being carried out to its end and gaining promises of democracy and economic reform is definitely, it's definitely a plus. It's very encouraging for people, and that's where I think the protests took off throughout the region, not just in Egypt.
One of the senses, too, is that it seems to be that the younger people are the ones who are at the forefront of this of the movement. Is that your sense, too, that they're disproportionately represented in the movement?
Not disproportionately. The organizers, if you will, I mean, it's definitely an organic populist uprising. But those who have been on the ground organizing the renewed protests, the protests have been consistent throughout the 12 days. But every ever so couple of days, every 3 or 4 days, they call for another million-man march. And those are organized by people on the ground. Those tend to be in the age group of late teens to late 20s, more or less, early 30s. Usually highly educated, mostly unemployed, but from what I've heard from people on the ground, there's people of all ages and all social backgrounds and religious groups. So it's a very diverse group of people that are out there.
excuse me. Thanks for joining us. This is Gus. One of the fears that I have about this this uprising is that even though I know it seems very complicated, because even though I know that Mubarak was assisted in his reign by the United States and other Western powers, now all of a sudden they're turning on him and saying that, you know, they think he should step down immediately and that there should be a peaceful, you know, transition, and that they're going to threaten pulling foreign aid from them unless he steps down quickly. They also had problems with him shutting off the internet and the cell phone blockages. But whenever I see the West back somebody or turn against them, that sends up a red flag, you know, because it makes me wonder, do they have an ulterior motive, or are they just trying to save face and have some kind of salvage some kind of outcome in this? I mean, I'm really afraid that whoever ends up in control is going to be just another stooge.
Yeah, are you suggesting that CIA maybe has lined up a replacement? They reconciled
the
Mubarak.
Yeah, because they're afraid that they see that there's a populist uprising, and
so
they
want to
make
it,
sure that they channel that rage into a useful tool in the end.
What do you think of that, Suwad?
I actually think that is a very, very good point, and many people probably do share that sentiment, especially in the Middle East itself.
Okay.
Mubarak himself was an ally, and if you recall, towards the beginning of the unrest, the American, or the White House stance at least, was pretty much uncertain on where to stand on that.
Uh-huh.
I think, as a champion of democracy, if you will, the United States does have to save face to a certain extent, and it does have to support, you know, democratic movements, while at the same time, it does need to look out for its interests. This isn't exactly confirmed, but I have heard that there are talks between the two governments that the transition of power will be made to the new Prime Minister, Ahmed Shafiq, who pretty much chose the same party line as Mubarak. So,
okay.
So is that a transfer? Then it's more of a cosmetic change.
Exactly. His first speech, when he came out and addressed the people, he said that he was replacing the entire ministry while staying himself.
Right, the cabinet.
Exactly, the cabinet. And that was completely cosmetic.
Right.
It was just a reshuffle. It was nothing more than a reshuffle. So
changing a suit. Yeah.
Exactly.
This seems like I'm harking back to the French Revolution. How revolutions get started and they take on a dynamic, and nobody knows where it's going to end up. You had the King of France called the Estates General, and then the Third Estate, the bourgeoisie, went off and met separately, formed its own government, and just things went completely out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think something like that, some kind of scenario, that we're going to see things happen out of control here, or do you think this is going to be carefully managed?
Like I said, it is a spontaneous uprising, and anything can go from there. But for the most part, The political factions, the crowd's pretty much has been faceless. The political factions are in the crowd, but they're not the crowd, if you can understand the distinction.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to be directed any one particular way. In the Tahrir Square itself, there's a big poster that pretty much covers a 20-story building that declares the protesters 7 or 8 points of change that they want. And I think the people are pretty concrete on those things.
That's interesting. In following the mainstream media here in the United States, I have not heard a single one of those demands.
Yeah, what are they?
I've heard it best summarized as a want for democracy and social justice. They include the primary one has been the step down of Mubarak and the current regime in total, and then the beginning of a new government through a temporary interim government and elections and so forth. Constitutional reform is a very, very stressed and long asked for amendment that needs to be done. They want to change Article 76, 77, and 88. Those are all constitutional articles that support the current presidential system. There's no limit on terms. It makes it very, very, very difficult for anyone who's not an NDP or the National Democratic Party member to run for president.
Okay.
So those all fall under the line of democracy. People are asking for, you know, fair wages and things along those lines. And they're very simple, and any constructive government can address them in any given time period. But one that's not so concerned with reform, obviously, can neglect those for a while.
Is there one of the I always want to try to go back and find a historical context. Obviously, that's what our show is about, in context. When we talk about Middle East uprisings and overthrows, we can go back to Iran in 1953, where they had a religious-based government with the Shah, and then they instituted a democratic government that was a non-religious-based government system. And then the United States goes and overthrows it again because we can't control a free democracy, but you can control a religious-based dictatorship, essentially. So
yeah.
Saudi Arabia, Iran, they are run by, you know, a single-minded religious system. What I fear in Egypt now, I heard today that they had talks with the Muslim Brotherhood. Is there any possibility where the government could be changed over to be a solely single-minded religious, type of system like Iran or Saudi Arabia that's just kind of a sham, because even though they share the religious values of the people, their leadership is unquestioned and corruptible.
I definitely understand your point. There is a point of distinction that I do want to make, though, where my opinion might depart from yours,
okay.
Is that I don't think that the theocratic perspective in government is one that makes it not malleable with the population, if you will. I think it's the dictatorial system, period.
Okay.
So the one thing that these theocratic governments have in common is that they are also dictatorships.
Okay. No, that's a fair point.
That aside, the Muslim Brotherhood has done, like, it really has gone out of its way to not come to the forefront. The Muslim Brotherhood didn't even acknowledge its presence in the crowds until about 4 or 5 days in.
Okay.
And when it did, recently, a couple of days ago, the Brotherhood came out and officially said that it will not put up a candidate for presidency.
Oh.
So they're really just kind of letting the winds of change take their course.
I see.
What that means for the future is undetermined, of course. They are, in some areas, a popular group. And obviously they would probably gain a fair number of seats in parliament. But Egypt is more or less a lot more secular than other regional countries.
Okay, that's interesting to know. Is the Muslim Brotherhood, I heard, was outlawed? Was that correct?
Yes, the Muslim Brotherhood goes back to the 1920s and the resistance movement against the English in Egypt. And so it has a lot of history. It initially started kind of as a social movement instead of a political movement. they throughout Egyptian history have built
Excuse me, if I can interrupt you 1 second, yeah. Suwad. I just wanted to announce the phone number in case people wanted to join our conversation. Yeah. You're listening to In Context. Our guest is Suwad Al-Assar. We're talking about the uprising in Egypt, and our call-in number here is 203-336-9756. 203-336-9756. If you want to join this conversation, you're invited to call us in at that number. Yes, Suwad, I'm sorry, you were talking about the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, just historically they've been, they've assisted with social needs like schools and hospitals and things like that. So around the 50s, around right after the revolution and the evacuation, if you will, of British troops, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who became our first president, outlawed them. He outlawed them because, and this is speculation, but because of their popular support. Throughout the following decades, they would have a military wing that would become very active. This would come to a peak around the 80s, of course, with the assassination of Sadat and a couple of incidences afterwards. They then were outlawed, and it wasn't until recent years that they were allowed to participate in parliamentary elections and things like that. But for the most part, their political activity is very, very limited, and thousands are detained.
Okay.
That's a- if there was a government that was elected that reflected the popular will, what kind of government do you think would come out? How important would, say, the Muslim Brotherhood be versus secularists? Would pro-American or pro-Western people versus people who are anti-Western? Do you have any sense of how a truly democratic government would work out in that regard?
The political spectrum in Egypt is just so diverse. Again, I'm emphasizing that the Muslim Brotherhood does have a popular base. It's not, again, it's not the crowd, like I was saying. A truly democratic outturn would probably include everyone, really. You have not just, another distinction I want to make, the pro-Western or anti-Western sentiments. For now, Egyptians are really focusing internally. The foreign policy of Egypt, more or less, is going to be put aside, and I'm pretty sure it's going to remain as is for the next coming years, no matter what the turnout is. But I think domestically, it would probably reflect a wide variety of people, and they would probably all focus on the reforms that need to be undertaken.
Most key right now is just food, electricity, shelter, you know, the necessities.
And unemployment. Of course, Americans tend to focus on Egypt's foreign policy because our massive amount of aid that we've given to Egypt since the Camp David Accords has assured them that they have not been antagonistic towards Israel. If a new government came in, would you expect, for example, a new government to have stood aside during an attack such as occurred when Israel attacked the Gaza area in December of 2008? Or would the new government, for example, take down the barrier that separates Gaza and Egypt?
Like I said, I strongly believe that the status quo is probably going to stay as is. Mm. But you have to, I think I should emphasize the fact that Egypt walks a very thin line in regional politics because it is a pro-Western ally, or its government has been at least. But it also has a historical position in championing Arab rights, if you will, and regional politics. So it has to not kind of step on the toes of Israel and Western interests, while at the same time doing at least the minimal to preserve a degree of dignity on the Palestinian part. So I believe that any new government will continue to walk that line.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM, and we're talking about the uprising in Egypt with Suwad Al-Azhar, the political scientist and writer.
Yeah, I have a question about El Baradei, who the Western media, mainstream media, has been sort of looking to as a go-to figure in this crisis, where they're saying he's the logical solution or leader or popular support to take over. And that concerns me, because he was the immediate person that they latched onto, and he's Western educated. He's part of the UN. He's a very well-spoken English-speaking man. So it just sort of seems like maybe that's the logical solution for the Americans and the British, but is he the logical solution for the Egyptians?
That's definitely a point that needs to be brought up. El-Baradei has a vast amount of international credibility.
Mm-hmm.
On the domestic level, he does have a history in promoting change and democracy in Egypt. He's the founder. In 2010, he founded the National Association for Change, I believe it's called in English, and so he does kind of have his hands a little bit dirty in politics. But a fair enough portion of Egyptian society doesn't really put their chips on him. So so he has the international credentials. I want to emphasize that again. But domestically, I personally believe he would be really good for an interim government. But beyond that, I'm not entirely sure.
Okay, that's a good answer, I think. Ken, did you have any more questions?
Well, casting our net a little wider, we have the popular uprising in Tunisia and the dictator Ben Ali, who's been there, I believe, for over 30 years. He fled it just a few weeks ago. And now we have this uprising in Egypt. What other countries in the region do you think you're going to see? Are you going to see this spread, say, to Yemen, where they have the dictator Saleh, or Jordan with King Abdullah II? Are we going to see this break out in country after country?
I've heard even in Saudi Arabia there's a lot of discontent among the youth there in the lower classes, because only the upper classes are the ones who are actually doing well off of the oil money.
So which countries, Suwad, do you think are the most apt to have a successful popular uprising if this should spread?
Well, I can tell you for a fact that I have heard of actual protests having begun in Yemen and Jordan and Algeria and Syria as well.
Okay.
And so whether these come to fruition or not obviously will have to depend on their circumstances on the ground. The King of Jordan has proposed several changes. He announced that he is not going to have his son succeed to power, and he removed the ministers. The Yemeni president has given several small concessions, and I think the agreement to give these concessions throughout the region in areas where there are protests is symbolic of a wave of change that is happening. And so while these dictators themselves may not fall, and this may not be the end of dictatorship in the region, I mean, that would be nice, obviously, but a little far-fetched. I believe that democratic change, maybe, but at least social change is on the way.
Okay. And now we look at it from the other point of view. If you were the American architect of American foreign policy, what would you suggest to our leaders as a way to deal with these movements of popular unrest in the Mideast?
I think, again, like I said earlier, America also walks a thin line between saving face in the areas where it's promoting certain things globally and also searching for its own domestic and international interests.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best thing to do is to let these populations kind of play their own roles where they are and just kind of let them take care of things themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that can't happen exclusively. The United States is going to look for opponents that it can support. And so what I would like and what might actually happen are probably two different things.
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yes, thank
Suwad.
You very much.
We appreciate it very much. Hope
thank
to speak
you for
to
having
again.
Me.
Good night,
thank
Suwad.
Good night. Night. Good night.
And listeners, thank you for joining us again on In Context, WPKN's live call-in show. This is Ken McDermott-Rowe. I'm here with Gus Cantavera. This program will be archived at our website at www.incontextreport.com, where you can make comments and sign up for announcements and podcasts. In Context is produced by MDR Productions and is broadcast on the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. Join us on Wednesday, March the 2nd at 6:30, when we'll be talking about alternative cancer cures with Tanya Harder Pierce, author of Outsmart Your Cancer. And special thanks to Dave Schwartz for doing a great job of engineering our show tonight.
And our volunteer from the Bridgeport University, Andrew Wolford, joining the show.
Thank you for being here too, Andrew. So we'll see you soon. Thank you, listeners.
Take care.
Good night.